We're here today with Brian Mazzola, a partner with Boyd Richards, Parker & Colonelli, to gain insight into the current shape of employment and housing laws and to learn more about the key topics covered in board responsibilities as employer and housing provider, such as discrimination, disability claims and allowances, and payment for overtime.
So if you want to start off by telling me about where you're seeing the most litigation currently against boards, where the largest issues are.
We see an emerging trend that boards, it's not so much the litigation that is seen, but the role that a board plays in the litigation and the need to understand that board members as volunteers are actually employers, and they simply cannot rely on the managing agent, and they simply cannot rely on the CBA and ignore the issues that come up in running a building.
In terms of overtime, which I think you'd mentioned has been involved in recent lawsuits with superintendents, can you go into detail in terms of what the recent case law has been and how that could impact the liability of board members directly, especially regarding superintendents?
Sure, and this is a hot topic. Fair Labor Standards Act. FLSA claims are very easy to prove. They're very employee friendly. The courts are very favorable to the plaintiffs who bring their cases. And so we see a trend with superintendents typically who are bringing claims because they live in the residence, they're there for emergencies. They may wake up in the middle of the night to handle a flood or a boiler which is broken, and their hours are usually not tracked. It's hard to track somebody who lives in a building and may just casually be working. So it's not new law, but the law states that as long as a person is performing work to the benefit of the employer, that person needs to be paid. And when there's no time records, and it's often the case where the time records are incomplete or inaccurate, the favorable inference is given to the employee that that person worked the hours. And what I see typically when a case comes in under FLSA claim, the board would like to turn its attention to the managing agent and say to the managing agent, where are those records? And managing agents sometimes don't have the records for better or for worse. And boards think that they can insulate their liability by pointing the finger at the managing agent, but that's not the case. They are employers and they can be held liable, and the damages in an FLSA case not only easy to prove, but they go up quickly. And a person who can show that they're entitled to X amount of dollars in overtime can almost certainly double that under the penalty scheme on the FLSA plus attorney's fees. And anybody is an employer. As long as there's one employee, you're an employer for purposes of FLSA. Now, I'll note that there is some sense of protection for a board with a living superintendent in that usually when these claims are brought, they're brought both on the FLSA and under the state wage law. But under the state wage law, superintendents are usually considered living janitors and are exempt. So there is some protection. But just because they're exempt under state law, they're not exempt under federal law. And there's usually limited insurance coverage under FLSA claims. I have to fight to eliminate the state law claims, which eats away at the insurance policy and then takes time. So those are very dangerous claims.
Interesting. And in terms of the request to the superintendent to do the overtime work, I guess today it can be put in writing through text or email, or does that impact it at all? Like as to you can show that you requested the superintendent did work, or the superintendent's claiming that he did work, but nobody asked him to. What do you see in terms of that?
I think maybe not with a superintendent, with the staff, it's easier to make the request for them to work overtime and put it in writing. With a superintendent, it's not always feasible because that person is responding to emergencies. And I think best practice would be for the superintendent to write up an incident report if there's a flood, say that they had to address it at the time and how many hours they worked, and submit it into the managing agent or to the board, however that is reported, so we could keep track of it. And the other best practice is if a board catches somebody working overtime that's unauthorized or is made up, that person should be disciplined and told and warned that if it happens again, you know, there's progressive discipline, ultimately leading to termination if they're stealing hours and they're trying to put in for time that they actually did not work, or if they worked for time that they were not authorized. because the law will protect a board or an employer who takes action to prevent the unauthorized working of overtime. However, if an employee does work unauthorized overtime, they're entitled to collect for it. The CLE is also going to cover boards in handling disability claims in any employer role and as a landlord.
So in terms of disability claims, what type of responsibility does the board have and what can they do to help prevent issues from occurring?
So the board has two roles when it concerns disability. The first is as an employer and the second as a landlord, but they both have the same responsibilities under the law that if someone makes a request for a reasonable accommodation, the board, and this can be through board members or it could be through their managing agent, needs to engage in an interactive process in order to determine what accommodation is needed for the disability. And a lot of times when I get litigation is because nobody engaged in an interactive process. Nobody took the request serious. The easy example is a dog in a no-dog building. I've seen plenty of litigation where somebody who's disabled, who claims to be disabled, needs a dog. They bring a dog into the building, and the board's answer is get the dog out, and landlord-tenant proceedings are initiated. And now I have not only a disability claim, but I also have a retaliation claim. And so I think it's important for the board members to understand when that request is made, even if you're a no-dog building, that there needs to be a serious sit-down and determine what that person needs and if the accommodation can be offered. And the same holds true if there's an employee who makes a request. And in that circumstance, maybe the managing agent will sit down, but the board needs to give the managing agent the direction to sit down and discuss what the disability is and what the accommodation they need is.
And with an employee that's claiming disability, does the issue usually involve what they can and cannot be asked to do in terms of their normal job, how the board addresses that while still getting the work done without having an increased workforce?
Yes. So a big question will come up, and that is whether or not the person can perform the essential functions of their job. And there's three laws that may cover a building depending on the size of the staff. You have the federal, which requires a larger number of people for jurisdiction, but the trap is the New York City law, and the definitions are very different as to what a disability is, and the definitions are very different as to what a reasonable accommodation is. And so, for example, under the city law, when an employee comes forward and says that they need a certain accommodation, that accommodation is given preferential treatment and is deemed to be reasonable under the law, and the board would have a burden of coming back and saying it's unreasonable. And so we often see where if you have, say, a handyman who cannot perform the essential functions of his job, there's a question of whether he should be moved to a different position if one is available, whether time off is needed. And another big issue that we see a lot in disability cases is if an employee goes on disability, when he can return and is able to perform those essential functions of his job. And so I've seen a number of cases recently where the person has, let's say, shoulder surgery, and the question is whether he can lift something above his waist level, and that comes into play with taking out garbage and trimming trees and picking up leaves, shoveling snow.
And in those cases, is it different ramifications if you are a 3-employee building or 20-employee building? Are there cutoffs in terms of what you're required to provide, or is it constant throughout?
The New York City human rights law deems an employer for purposes of the law if there's 4 or more employees. And so that is the lowest common denominator. You need more under the federal and the standards of whether or not someone is disabled or stricter under the federal law. But here, boards cannot rely on the federal law. It's going to go back down to in most cases that we're dealing with in the 5 boroughs, it's going to come down to the city law and the city law protection.
So one topic we haven't discussed so far is discrimination and harassment and the board's role in those issues from the perspective of an employer and also as a landlord. Do you want to go into that now?
Today, it's important on gender claims and with sexual harassment in particular, because the law actually has been amended to state for purposes of sexual harassment, any employer with 1 employee is subject to liabilities, not just the 4 employees. And there are extra protections that are given in sexual harassment type of cases, and if the person files with the New York City or the New York State Human Rights Division, the Division of Human Rights, the claims, I cannot put them into arbitration if there's a CBA in place, because the public agencies have a right to investigate. And there's other things for the boards to consider, such as the law now does not permit an employer to go on a settlement agreement to have an automatic confidentiality provision, which is very important if you're dealing with small staff or if you're in a building where people like to talk. The law states that a person, in order to get a confidentiality agreement, it is the plaintiff's preference, and the plaintiff has extra protections. They have 21 days to consider, and they have 7 days to revoke after considering it. And so some plaintiff's attorneys may say they want extra money if you want a confidentiality provision that's put into an agreement.
So in wrapping up, are there any key issues that you think that we haven't touched on today? And or is there any advice that you'd like to give to boards regarding best practices and how they can avoid liability?
One other important item that I would point out, and why I think it's especially important for boards and really board members to pay attention to what the laws are, to make sure they attend training, to have some sort of education on this issue, is that there's really exposure to individual liability. And if a person is on the board and participates in a decision or makes comments or does something that could violate the law, they can't simply hide behind the business judgment rule. They can't hide behind it's a board decision. There's a chance, especially under the city law, that someone can name them as a defendant, and they're going to have to defend themselves. And hopefully, if they get out on liability, but that person is going to be involved in a lawsuit and will have to participate, be deposed, and go through that process.
And is that true for all aspects of employment law? I know it's for discrimination, and I assume also for harassment. What about like in terms of overtime or giving someone an instruction that maybe would cause them to be injured or is against other city regulations, or people or board members freed under the indemnity clause in their governing documents, or are they individually liable in those types of cases too?
It depends on the circumstance, I think. It depends on what that person's participation was. I mean, it certainly can be subject to liability under FLSA. And that's a little bit of a different analysis. Can the person be considered an employer under the law? I don't think that you can show that a single board member is an employer. But on the other hand, I've had this happen, if you have a board member who talks to handyman and has that person perform work in their apartment on the side, or the allegations I've seen also are the board president had told me, I need you to do this work in the common area, just handle it, it'll be okay, maybe I'll give you a day off, and no, that's not sufficient under the law. And so I've seen board presidents be named as co-conspirators or people who were involved in trying to avoid having them being paid. So, yes, it's certainly an issue under FLSA, and even if the person cannot be held liable, I think savvy lawyers know that if they name people individually, there may be a better chance of having a quicker, more advantageous resolution, because that person doesn't want to be dragged through a lawsuit and may be able to push for a bigger settlement.
Right.
Well, thank you, Brian, very much for your time, and we'd like to invite you to join us at Board Responsibilities as Employer and Housing Provider, where Brian will cover this topic in much greater detail. Thank you.